Morning. Happy Lord's Day to you. Happy New Year's to you. Glad to see you, all of you. I'm glad you're here today when you could be doing other things. I'm glad you're here to worship God. It's an encouragement to me. And I was thinking today, it's all about how you word things. So to say that we've been a church for 3 years... Well, we've existed in 3 different years. So, last part of 2016, all of 17, and as of tomorrow, and barring any catastrophic event, 2018. So, it's all about how you word things. Today, we're starting Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm going to start, as usual. I think today, the best thing that would serve us would be to simply read the text, and to go from there. And so, I'm going to read to you Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. They go like this. Seeing the crowds, he, being Jesus, went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." I debated in my own mind what would serve us as a church best, and when it comes to the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, as all of these blessed R's are known, it seems like you either need to take them in one big gulp or one very small bite at a time. And I opted for the big gulp. That's not a plug for 7-Eleven, not a big gulp. I opted for the overview. I opted for I'd rather we walk away from the Beatitudes with a good overall picture of what Jesus is saying than a more detailed version of that. And some people would preach through this much more slowly. None of those people are preaching here today. So we're going to attempt to go through all of the Beatitudes in today's sermon. But they're worthy of your personal study. They're worthy of your personal meditation and memorization. Absolutely. I hope today helps you get an overall vision for what Jesus is saying in verses 1 through 12 of Matthew chapter 5. But first, about what in your life have you had a wrong idea? Maybe for years. A wrong idea or a wrong impression that has since been corrected. About what in your life have you been wrong about that has been corrected in your life? Usually when someone with more wisdom and experience steps in and tells us, you know, you really don't have the full picture of that, or you might not quite understand what you're saying. Because we've all held positions, opinions, and impressions that at some point have been found to be in error, either partially or fully. None of us was born right about everything. Very few of us, anyway. No one that I know, especially in my own household and family. And it can be really small things. "Are you sure we should do that? Oh yeah, mom and dad won't mind." And then they mind. Or, "Teacher won't care if the assignment is late," and then they do care, and it reflects in your grade. Or, "Don't talk to that neighbor. He's a mean old grump. Stay away from him." And then you find yourself in conversation with that neighbor and just learn he's a really nice, personable guy. We've all been wrong about things. Maybe bigger picture things, though. Maybe something like ethnic prejudice. Maybe we've thought a certain way about a certain group of people our entire lives, and we've found it very easy to make jokes about them or to say ungodly things about them. And then, like myself, we find ourselves in boot camp sharing a room with 80 men from all these different ethnicities, and suddenly my opinion has changed largely. Some of the greatest men I've ever known look nothing like me. Or maybe it's something like raising children. Isn't it so easy to raise other people's children? And then you have your own kids and you realize that might not be as simple as I thought it was. We've all had ideas that have been reshaped. I couldn't resist but share this story to help emphasize this before we move on. A couple of you, well, David and James, have had the privilege of meeting an old friend of mine. His name is Steve Teeter, and he pastors the church we pray for in Franklin, West Virginia. Steve is a native of Pendleton County, West Virginia, born and raised, a second-generation dentist turned pastor. And when Steve was a child in the 1960s in Pendleton County, his father, Bird Teeter, who just passed away at the age of 92 a couple months ago, his dad leased out some land. I don't remember for what purpose, but Bird Teeter leased out some land in Pendleton County, West Virginia. And if you've ever been through West Virginia, you know that there are no flat spots. And so to find a flat spot to lease some land is a big deal. And he had a vision for that land and he leased it out. But there was a problem. The neighboring landowner had some goats that he didn't keep track of, that he didn't keep penned in. And they came and went as much as they wanted to onto the Teeter's newly leased property, destroying, as you know, goats have a tendency to do, and eating whatever they felt like. And so Bird Teeter and his son Steve and his other brother set about building a fence, a long fence on this stretch of property to attempt to keep the goats out. And it was tedious, Steve told me. It was hard work. It was a long stretch of land. And as they're building this fence, his father, in frustration one day, made the offhand comment, and I'm sure learned to regret it. He said, "Boy, we ought to just shoot those goats." So Steve and his brother, thinking they were doing the will of their father, took their single shot 22 rifle and they shot those goats. I think Steve was 7 or 8. His brother was not much older, maybe 10 or 11. And thinking dad would be really pleased with them, they went out and shot those goats and ended up dumping them off of a cliff where some men were fishing in the river beneath. And it was raining goats that day. So surely dad will be happy with us. Well, he wasn't. And you can imagine the fallout that came afterwards. So Steve and his brother had a very wrong idea about their father's expectations and about what their father wanted from them. They thought they were doing a great thing. Turns out they weren't. Welcome to the Sermon on the Mount. Chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew. They are the longest discourse of Jesus in the Bible. The longest single package of his teaching in the entire Bible are Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. The Sermon on the Mount is quite famous. You know it even if you only simply grew up going to some Sunday school classes. Some of these verses and passages will be familiar to you, as they should be. Here in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, we have God correcting people's wrong ideas. We have God reshaping minds and hearts, giving them the correct impression, but not about trivial things, about big issues like righteousness and holiness and what it means to be truly blessed in eternity. Big issues. God sits down and opens his mouth and teaches. And so we listen as the disciples listened. Because we need our minds renewed. We need our hearts reshaped. And when God speaks, we listen. He tells us how to think, how to feel, how to act. This is a sermon. This is Jesus' sermon. And this sermon is instruction for how his kingdom people are supposed to live. How they are supposed to feel. How they are supposed to think. Just by way of quick review, because we've been out of Matthew for a few weeks. The king has come. And he fulfilled the Old Testament in doing so. He is the true and better Adam. He has passed through the waters of baptism. He is the perfect Israelite. He is the Son of God, we learn at his baptism. And then when Satan challenges that title, Jesus proves his sonship. So the king has come and he's been on ministry, teaching and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing, proving his divinity, proving his title as son. And now with the attention of his disciples and with the attention of crowds. He takes them on the mountain and he opens his mouth and he says, yes, the kingdom is here, and this is how kingdom people are to live. Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, they are for us. If we are followers of Jesus, these chapters are for us. They remove guesswork for what God's will is for our lives and how we ought to live on a day-to-day basis. But keeping in mind that this is a sermon, this is Jesus' sermon today, my sermon is just about his sermon introduction. It's kind of like Inception, a sermon in a sermon. And so this entire sermon is just about the first part of his sermon. So for what it's worth, this is meant to get our minds going in the right direction, but we have a long way to go through Jesus' sermon. But I think we'll glean some good things today. Just like in the disciples' day, there are many voices clamoring about how we ought to live, aren't there? You have different influences and different voices telling you how you ought to live every day. Some of them more overt, some of them subliminal. And all of them claiming various levels of an arbitrary morality. Especially when it comes to how humans should exist in relation to God. Some might say, God just wants you to be happy. That's what God wants. He wants you to be happy. And then another voice chimes in and says, well, God just really wants you to do your best. That's what God wants. Another voice comes in from the side and says, God isn't concerned about your behavior at all. Just recite this creed, or go through this process, or go through this ceremony, and you'll be fine. Another voice steps in and says, you're all wrong. God is irrelevant, or maybe doesn't exist at all. And in the midst of all that noise, in the midst of all those voices and all of the confusion, the voice of God breaks through and silences all others and tells us plainly, my followers live like this. It's like when my son Daniel, I drop him off at school, and before everyone goes in, they're on the playground playing, and it's chaos. It's K through 5. It's chaos, and there's children running everywhere. Some of them are yelling and shouting and freezing to death because their parents didn't put a coat on them. Some of them are bleeding. And it's chaos. But when that whistle blows, Daniel knows he looks for Miss Brown, and he lines up directly in front of her. Similarly, amidst the confusion, God speaks, and his followers fall in line. That's what we see in the Sermon on the Mount. With various voices claiming to have favor with God. And who wouldn't want favor with God? If God exists, would you want to be on good terms with him? Well, I don't know a person that would say, nah. Of course we want to be on good terms with God. And so in today's sermon, we will seek to answer this question. Does your definition of a blessed person match God's definition of a blessed person? There are many voices, but here we have God speaking, so we pay attention. The predominant word in this passage obviously is blessed, and we already went through the blessed, blessed controversy. I don't want to revisit that. I was taught to say blessed. That's what it says on the page. That's what I'm going to say. If you're more comfortable hearing blessed, just replace my words in your own mind with the word blessed, but I'm going to say blessed. Blessed is the predominant word in this passage. Blessed are these people. Blessed are these people. Blessed are these people. God is telling us what it means to be truly blessed. So the question is, does your definition match God's? In other words, what is your understanding of how we ought to live? We all want to be blessed, and how do we measure that? How do we quantify that? What does that look like, really? Because when I say the word blessed, I don't know what comes to your mind. But in any home that is nominally religious in any sense, even in the slightest, there's bound to be some sort of wooden or wire decoration somewhere in the house that says blessed in fancy cursive. There is in our house. I'm not knocking anybody. But what a common word. We use the word blessed all the time. What comes to your mind when you hear the word? Now, I did a search for hashtag blessed on Twitter. And I just want to share a few of my favorite results with you to give you the idea of what the world thinks of what it means to be blessed. One was a woman pro wrestler performing for the first time in Madison Square Garden. Hashtag blessed. Another was a teen who had just visited a dermatologist who gave the teen the good news that he could, in fact, clear up the teen's face. Hashtag blessed. Many people had just been accepted to a college. Hashtag blessed. I saved my best for last, and I'm going to do a direct quote. I don't know who this person is, but they tweet, "Going in the new year with fresh braids. Gotta hook myself up. 2018, I'm ready for you. Hashtag blessed." That was my favorite. I don't know. But then, I didn't coordinate this, but also in that feed, when I searched hashtag blessed, came a tweet from Desiring God, the ministry run by John Piper. And this is what they had to say. "The New Testament has 112 references to being hashtag blessed, and none of them is connected to material prosperity. Not one. The Bible, by all means, reveals to us a sovereign God who gives gifts and who orchestrates circumstances. Everything we have came from Him. So I am not trying to downplay the use of the word blessed, but I think we can find a deeper, maybe the deepest understanding of what it means to be blessed if we look. Everything is from God, but what does true blessedness look like? At its core, what does it mean to be blessed? As disciples of Jesus, they needed to know this. As disciples of Jesus, we need to know this. What is God's definition of blessed? Here's a helpful quote from a word study I did. I want to share this with you. It contrasts the pagan, and don't be thrown off by that word, it means non-Christian, the non-Christian usage at the time of Jesus, usage of the word blessed, because it was used by non-Christian poets and philosophers and such, versus the Christian understanding of it. It reads like this: "From the pagan word, the flavor of immortality is absent. No vision of abiding rest imparts patience and courage amidst the bitterness and struggle of life. No menace of the destiny of evil imposes a check on human lust." In other words, the pagan usage of the word blessed there's nothing long-lasting about it at all. The Christian word blessed is full of the light of heaven and emphasizes something which thrives on trial and persecution, which glories in tribulation, which not only endures, but conquers the world and expects its crown in heaven. And at this point, I've shown my hand just a little bit for what it means to be truly blessed. It has very little, if nothing, to do with anything material we might gain in this life. Not at its core, not at its deepest meaning. What a shock that may have been to the disciples. Maybe that's a shock to you today. Maybe you equated being blessed with all of the stuff I have, or how my health is going, or how long a life I've lived. I have three relatively short points to share with you that I see from Matthew 5, 1 through 12, to help us understand God's definition of what it means to be blessed. And the first is this: blessed people understand the great need of humanity. To be blessed starts with understanding the human condition. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. What a wonderful way to begin describing a disciple of Jesus, because no one who has come to faith and trust in Jesus has done so absent of an understanding of their own terrible depravity. Being blessed, being a disciple of Jesus, starts with understanding the great need of humanity at large and in our own lives. Poor in spirit, someone who is poor in spirit, is someone who recognizes that on a spiritual level, they need help. They need help on a spiritual level. That's what it means to be poor in spirit. They dare not follow their own natural tendencies and intuitions. They dare not. They need spiritual assistance, and they know this. They are intimately aware of their own spiritual bankruptcy. They are poor in spirit. Isaiah 66:2. I don't have this projected. It's a short passage. Please listen. Isaiah 66, verse 2. "All these things," speaking of creation, "all these things my hand has made, and so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. Coming to terms with who we are in light of who God is, that is the first characteristic of a blessed person. And so meek, blessed are the meek, I would put them in this category as well. Humble people who understand their position before a perfect God. God's people, or blessed people, they are keenly aware of sin and what it has done to our lives and our status before a perfect God. And so they look beyond themselves because they must. They must. They understand that they are poor in spirit. And so naturally, this leads to those who mourn. Blessed are those who mourn. It naturally leads to mourning because all mourning is connected to sin somehow. There would be no mourning if there was no sin and brokenness in this world. On a moral level, I think of the kings in the Old Testament who mourned over the sin of their nation. I'm thinking of like Psalm 55. I think of prophets who mourned over the sin of their people. I'm thinking of Elijah in places like 1 Kings 19. We mourn death and we mourn loss and brokenness and disease. All creation groans as a result of sin, we read in Romans. There are many great things in this life. There are many great things, but if you are a Christian, if you are known as one who mourns, you know that things are not as they should be. There isn't a person in this room who hasn't been affected by sickness or death. You know things aren't as they should be, and so you mourn. You mourn because this is not how things ought to be. And coming to terms with our own sinfulness and the sinfulness of the world and mourning over sin, not just acknowledging it, but mourning sin and brokenness, naturally we hunger and thirst for righteousness. We hunger and thirst for righteousness because we see that things are broken, we see that things need to be fixed, and we understand through God's revelation that there is a solution, that there's only one solution. The only solution is for God to fix things. It's beyond our power to do that. And these people, according to Jesus, are blessed. It starts with this understanding of how things really are. At the ground level, understand the state of your soul, understand the state of creation, and understand that there is only one who can fix it. That we need righteousness. Righteousness not of ourselves. We hunger and we thirst for righteousness and we cry out, God, would you fix things? To be blessed, to be a disciple of Jesus, starts there. But secondly, blessed people take the kingdom to others. It's not simply an internal endeavor. It's not simply a cognitive exercise where we come to understand sin and depravity in our armchairs and then we do nothing about it. It's not simply intellectual. I'm thinking of these passages. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the peacemakers. Known for their purity of heart. People who engage the world in such a way as to bring true peace and true reconciliation and to show true mercy. Blessed people take the kingdom to others. Christians, we care for others. Why? Why? Because if we truly grasp sin, if you truly have come to terms, you understand your own fallen self, you understand this broken world, and you are crying out for righteousness, you realize it's not a personal problem. It's not isolated to you. It is a global problem that transcends time. You see others in the same plight as you, and following the example of Jesus, you hurt for those people. You bring the kingdom to them. You show mercy. You make peace. And church, when we do this, we aren't just following Jesus' orders, we're following His example. That's why. We aren't just following His orders, we're following His example. When we come into the kingdom, when we are brought from darkness to light, from outside to the inside, the mission of the king becomes the mission of the king's people. That mission is imparted to us. We adopt that mission. And Jesus was about the business of bringing light to darkness, of bringing life to the dead. And that is the mission of his subjects as well. We are not separated from it. His mission becomes our mission. I don't know anybody from the testimony of my own life or history or this book who mourned more than Jesus or who had greater cause to mourn. He left the perfect fellowship of the Trinity and became feeble and weak and died a death he didn't deserve. Jesus mourned. Jesus was most merciful. He is the ultimate peacemaker. He's the only one who can bring lasting peace. He is the only one truly pure of heart. And since this is his kingdom and his mission, church, we do what he did. There's no other option if you're his follower. We do what he did. His people are meant to look like him. This is why you should get the question, why are you the way you are, Christian? You should get that question, and when you do, the answer is because that's how my king is. I'm just a poor representation of how good he is. I don't want you to see me, I want you to see him. We take the kingdom to others because Jesus' mission has become our mission. We show mercy to others because we've been shown mercy. We make peace with others because peace has been made with us, you see? Our behavior is never disconnected from the mission of God. If you are a Christian, your behavior is never disconnected from the mission of God. So these Beatitudes, they aren't just God's good ideas. They are reflections of who God is. And that should matter to you, Christian. They are reflections of who he is. And so we pursue them for the sake of Jesus and at the cost of persecution. We read in verses 10 through 12. At the cost of persecution, we attempt to make our lives look like the life of our king. We take the kingdom to others. So, if we truly understand our depravity, if we truly understand sin in the world, we don't leave that in our brains. It affects our behavior in our interaction with others as the kingdom is built. But third, blessed people live with eternity in mind. How can you live this way? How could you live selflessly? How could you live in a way that is focused on showing mercy to others or helping people find peace? How is that possible? That's not going to get you anywhere in this life. Well, no, by the world's standards, no, it's not. But blessed people live with eternity in mind. And at this point, church and guests, we see what true blessing consists of at its core. We see what it truly looks like. True blessing is the favor of God, not just for now, but that stretches into eternity. It is the favor of God that stretches into eternity through Jesus. How do I know that? Because look, Jesus takes out all the guesswork. He says things like, blessed are the poor in spirit. Well, how do you know they're blessed? For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are those who mourn. Well, what do you mean? How are they blessed? They shall be comforted. The meek will inherit the earth, and so on and so forth. He gives proofs of what being blessed looks like. These people are blessed. We know that because this will be theirs. And every one of these prizes, these end games, all of them are eternal. All of them are eternal. The poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Those who mourn, they will be comforted. This is coming from the mouth of God. I want that comfort. The meek will inherit the earth. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they will be satisfied. The merciful shall receive mercy. The pure in heart, they shall see God. They will see God. These are not a list of morals to live by for a happy and perfect life now. These are instructions for how we are to mirror our King with results that stretch into eternity. True blessedness stretches into eternity. The peacemakers shall be called sons of God. And those who are persecuted, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Their reward is great. Christian, this is your reward. This is your reward. You know it in part now. You will know it fully then. Because one day, church, we will see God as he is. One day we will know eternal comfort. One day the new heavens and new earth will be our new domain. We will fully know what it means to be a child of God. And one day we will be fully satisfied in God. That day is coming, but make no mistake, Christian, you are a signed and sealed member of the kingdom of God today. You are a member of the kingdom today. With eternity in mind, your citizenship is secure today. Your final destination is in stone. Your citizenship cannot be revoked. Your journey home is drawing to an end. You are blessed. And with a glorious eternity in mind and in view, knowing that eternity is coming, where it will only be good because God is there and God is only good, knowing that that's coming, you live like a kingdom member now. Because that is where you belong. So we live like it now. We cannot place our trust in anything temporary. That would be counter to the kingdom. We cannot place a high value on what's going to one day burn and pass away. That would be counter to the kingdom. We cannot waste our time and emotion and resources on that which will yield no lasting reward. That would be counter to the kingdom. Our reward is in heaven. It is eternal. Our true blessedness stretches into eternity through Jesus. To strive for anything else is counter to the kingdom. This is how Jesus begins his sermon. I have heard the Sermon on the Mount referred to as Jesus talking about his upside down kingdom. It's different from what we expected. Wait a minute, I thought the powerful were blessed. I thought the rich were blessed. I thought those with stuff and position and authority were blessed. And everything Jesus is saying is counter to that. Because like he says elsewhere, his kingdom is not of this world. Thank God his kingdom is not of this world. Because it's better. Because it's better. So we show mercy. We are humble. We seek righteousness. We yearn for righteousness and for things to be made right. It sounds backwards, doesn't it? That's not going to earn you position in this life. It's not going to build a big empire, not on this earth. And if you're wondering more about this, don't worry, because Jesus is going to use the next three chapters to talk more about this. This sounds really backwards, Jesus. This doesn't sound like how we've seen and read about these great kings who have built kingdoms before. I know. My kingdom's different. Because his kingdom alone is eternal. So things are done a little differently. And we look different from other kingdom subjects. We don't pursue power and authority and dominion or military might. We pursue humility because our king is humble. We pursue righteousness because our king is righteous. You see, he is different. And so his definition of blessed is what matters. I want us to start thinking in these categories as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. Today just serves as an introduction, but I want these chapters to correct our thinking. We need correction in our thinking. We need to hear from God what he desires and what members of his kingdom are meant to do. We need that. So please start thinking in those categories. And first and foremost, consider your own spiritual state. Consider the question, are you a member of this kingdom at all? Are you poor in spirit? Start there. Have you come to terms with your own sin? Do you realize your own great need for someone else to step in and bridge that gap between you and God? Do you understand that? Have you come to terms with your fallenness? That's the beginning of being blessed. But beginning implies that there's an end, and guess what? There's not. This being blessed stretches into eternity. And with eternity in mind, we can live counter to the world today. Blessed living means letting go of what's temporary and looking to what's eternal. Blessed living means not desiring a spotlight in this life. It means existing in humility, mourning over sin, desiring righteousness, which is available in Jesus, and will only come fully when Jesus comes to make it so. That's the day we look toward. These words spoken to the disciples on a hilltop centuries ago, they're spoken to you now. We're given that same glimpse into the very heart of God, and we learn what's important to him, and we learn what being blessed means, and what it means to be a disciple, And church, it starts with your own sin. That's where I encourage you to start. And if that's a journey that you've never been down, and you don't understand why Jesus needed to come, I want to talk to you afterward. I would take great joy in talking to you about that afterward. The world is telling you to seek fame and self-satisfaction and personal glory, but the voice of God, like we said, cancels out all others and tells us with authority how to live. That's what's happening in the Sermon on the Mount. So I am excited to go through chapters 5, 6, and 7 with you and to hear directly from the mouth of God what He desires for His people. Because, church, what the Bible testifies to and what history testifies to is God has only ever intended the best for His people. Amen? He has good things in store for us. And they stretch into eternity. Our hearts may seek our own interests, but Jesus tames the wayward heart and gives it a correct function, a heavenly function, a function that stretches into eternity. At this point, church, we're going to participate in the Lord's Supper. James is going to come forward and lead us in that. But as he does, I want to invite you. Now, participating in what we're going to do, it is something that's reserved for Christians, for people who are truly blessed, whose blessing stretches into eternity because they know their own sin and because they are dependent upon another righteousness, not their own. That's who this is for, this participating in the Lord's Supper. And if you have never categorized yourself as a follower of Jesus, but maybe today's the first day that that's true of you, I want to invite you, celebrate with us as a way of starting your life as a follower of Jesus. You would be welcome to do that. Let this minister you today. Let it minister to you today. I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then I'll ask the music team to join me up front. And then, James, you can lead us. Let's pray.